And I think that was the beginning of the use of hypnosis. I think it continued, and that there are many ways for hypnosis to take place that are not recognizable, not easily recognizable. So it's disguised hypnosis often. But many times it wasn't. Many times it was induced hypnosis. When I was in college, so this would have been, I went to college in 1956. So in those years, I was hypnotized by a professor at the school at Oswego. And he also used electricity on me. But I didn't remember that at all until I had a deprogrammer come to help me. So since maybe 58, that happened.
And you had also had become familiar with hypnosis through the work you were doing. I've got this flyer that for your Super Self program. How did you incorporate hypnosis?
This is a very long story, but I wanted to become a psychoanalyst, and I went into psychoanalytic training here in New York area. And I had taken about 7 courses, and I was really a top student, and I had a lot of recognition for it. I was put into advanced classes, and I have letters still from more than one of the professors saying how insightful and dedicated I am. And then, at the end of taking about 7 courses, I would have matriculated and started working in their clinic, but I had to take an oral exam by 2 people that hadn't ever taught me, 2 people who didn't know me. And so I went for the exam, and I failed it. They failed me. They wrote me a letter. I still have it. It says, even though, you know approximately what you should know at this level of your training, and even though you have excellent recommendations, and even though your work record is superior, and even though your teachers think you're terrific, we're going to fail you because we think you're too immature. So I failed the exam. And then I had this opportunity to get... so with that meant I couldn't see students. I couldn't see clients. I couldn't work in the clinic. And That was really hard on me to think. I had been thinking that I was a good student. I was looking forward to a career as a psychoanalyst, and it seemed to suit me. I was doing well, and then to fail, and then it was devastating in a way. But then after that, the same therapist who I sent you the picture of, who was hanging around my apartment after I got out of the hospital, mm-hmm. Who took me on a date to the hospital, who wrote me the letter that he thought he had to hurt me. Well, it was shortly after I failed that exam that I was walking down the street in New York, and I ran into him. And he had a book that he was carrying that he said was for me. And I hadn't seen him in years. And he said, gee, I was just carrying this book. Remember I told you I was going to give you this book sometime? Well, here it is. And this was another coincidence. So now whenever there's a coincidence that takes place in my life, I'm very wary because it could be a setup. So he and I had a talk, and I told him what was going on. And he said, well, you could start your practice, and you could use my office, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the next thing you know, I... started seeing clients in his office on Saturdays. I had supervision and everything, and it was something else that had been set up. Anyway, with his influence and the circumstances, I went for training in hypnosis then, and that's how I got into that. And then I started seeing people who came for hypnosis. Usually they came to break habits, like they were overweight or they smoked or something like that. Other things too, but that was those were the most common reasons that people came.
So did you ever test yourself in terms of how prone you are to being hypnotized in terms of the hypnotic induction?
Yes. I think on a scale of 1 to 5 that I score high, that I score 4. But I think that if Sometimes narco-hypnosis has been used on me, which means that you're injected with something and then you're hypnotized. And, you know, anyone, I think that anyone would be totally susceptible if that's done.
So the use of drugs makes you much more prone to being hypnotized.
Well, some drugs, you know, mm-hmm. some drugs, and I don't know which ones.
Right.
But I think sodium ambitol and stuff like that.
Right. Now, are you aware of other types of mind control technologies that were used on you or that you suspect?
Well, they use programming. We mentioned that. That would be the first thing. The Green Bomb programming, which involves conditioning. And then there are signals that are, I suppose that would be programmed, like hand signals or verbal signals, so that what you see triggers some kind of behavior. What you experience triggers some kind of behavior that has nothing to do in reality with the signal. For example, a certain signal of tapping three times might put you into a trance and might push you to doing something that was a post-hypnotic suggestion. Certain things that are said, like, remember the movie The Manchurian Candidate? And
mm-hmm.
they say, well, why don't you go play some solitaire? And then the next thing that's said to him is a command, and he does it, including he goes and jumps in the lake when that is accidentally said to him when he's in a bar one time.
So are you cognizant of how this was used in terms of triggers were being used to bring out some kind of programming?
Well, I don't know, really. I know that this is something that's been programmed that I understand, and that is people say something to you. It seems totally innocent. It seems so totally innocent that if I told you people are harassing me and you said, well, what is it that they're saying to you? And I said, well, they say travesty, travesty. You say, well, that's crazy. That does no harm to you. But it is one of the things that's said to me. It triggers a whole a group of associations related to being trapped in a network. And this is how it works, is that, say, in my whole life, no one said that to me until I was about 48 years old. And one day somebody said to me, could you pronounce your name for me? And I said, Shavesty. And they said, oh, Shavesty, travesty. Shavesty rhymes with travesty. And I thought, well, that's a weird thing to say to me. But then maybe the next week someone else said the same thing. And then the next week someone else said the same thing. And eventually, that became something that created anxiety in me, not because of what was said, but because if somebody said that to me and I was in Sydney, Australia, I would know that that person is in on it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's like I'm connected to a whole network. It's such an unusual thing to say. Another thing that was said to me is maybe once, and one day, maybe seven different people came to me and said, do you know what time it is? Now, that was strange, and so I sort of noted that. But then the next day, maybe the same thing happened. And after that, anytime somebody says that to me, I'm reminded. It's like it reactivates this feeling that, oh, God, I'm in a network of people who are doing strange things. And I recently was talking to a person who is a mind control experimentee, and she had the same thing happen, that 20 different people in one day said to her, do you know what time it is? So after that, anytime somebody says that to you, you're reminded. It's like tapping into that feeling of being a victim or being trapped.
But they are using very common things that would, you know, for somebody to have somebody come up to them and ask them the time, that wouldn't seem unusual, except for
right.
the fact that it happens so often with you in
particular
times.
It's an area that's been traumatized, right?
Right, and I'm getting the feeling that these are just a few examples of
right.
Other kinds of coincidences.
And it's so clever of them to do this, because if you try to explain to somebody who doesn't understand what's going on, you sound like you're crazy. That doesn't sound like harassment, does it? That, you know, somebody asks you what time it is? And it's just this devious devious planning that sets it up that way so that you look crazy. It makes you just look worse than you did before you tried to explain yourself.
Now, you do have a legal case against the Cornell Medical Center at New York Hospital.
Right. It's been for 7 years in the Supreme Court, and it has just gone to, or for 6 years, I guess it opened in 1991.
Mm-hmm.
It's just gone to the Court of Appeal because, you know, I'm afraid of doctors, and they want me to go to their psychologist or psychiatrist for an examination.
Mm.
And I want to be excused from that, or go to someone that's appointed by the court or something. But the judge who had this case in his court, when I asked for that, he dismissed the case. I didn't have a hearing on it or anything. He just dismissed it, and so it went to the Court of Appeal.
So is the case against the medical center for wrongly detaining you at the hospital?
Yes, there are. I think there are 13 allegations, and it's for violations of civil rights and for I think malpractice.
And what can you tell us about the current status of your legal case?
Well, I'll tell you about the whole legal battle. It's been really hard. First of all, I had a hard time finding someone to take the case. Several people who said they would take it and did take it looked at it for, one person kept it 16 months before he gave it back to me. And as soon as I opened the case, 6 weeks later, the hospital opened the case against me. So I've been struggling with that. And though their case against me has been dismissed twice, and it's been off the calendar for over a year, and they were trying to open it again this summer, and now they say they're not going to. I mean, it's been 6 years that they've been, it seems like, torturing me with it. And I think if they had a case, they would have won it by now. You know, they have the best resources and lawyers available. That case has been in and out of court for all these years, and my case has had a lot of problems because there have been delays on the parts of judges in making decisions, and I don't know, it just seems so slow. I'm trying to get through real heavy mud here.
In terms of their case against you, what was the nature of the allegations?
They wanted to sue me for fees, believe it or not. And though they had never billed me, they just opened a lawsuit against me. So they didn't have any grounds. I mean, I never signed any papers. I told them from the very beginning that I had no means of paying them, and I didn't have insurance. I didn't have the kind of money to pay for hospital bills like that, and I didn't have any need to be there. One of the things that happened was the lawyer that I hired to defend me in that case created a false affidavit, which, if he would have been able to present it in court, would have been evidence that they could have used in this other case that I have against them. So the false affidavit that he created would have not only lost that case for me, but it would have been evidence that possibly would have lost my case against them. And this is what happened, is that about maybe 3 weeks before he and I were to go to court, this lawyer, I saw the papers that he was using, planning to present, And I told him, you know, this is, I didn't say this, this is a false affidavit. I do not want you to represent me any further. But you know what? He refused to stop representing me. I was unbelievable. So even though I told him that, and even though I wrote him a registered letter, he insisted on going to court. So I was bewildered as to what I should do, but I went to court on the same day. So when my case was called, the lawyer for the hospital went up before the judge, and he went up before the judge, and I went up before the judge, and I handed the judge the papers that I had sent to him, and I said, Your Honor, this is what's going on here. I don't want this man representing me. And the judge looked at what I had written, and he was very harsh with him, and he said, these are very serious allegations she is making. You do what she says. You withdraw from this case immediately. So.
And this was your own lawyer that had.
Yeah, this was the guy that I hired to help me.
So he had an affidavit that was supposedly written by you. What was the nature of that affidavit?
The affidavit was only false in its the way that it was put together. There was no actual word in it that was false. But it said things like, I left the hospital at the first opportunity. But the way that that was written was, I did leave the hospital at the first opportunity. But the first opportunity that I should have been allowed to leave the hospital at was the first day that I was there, when their own psychiatrist wrote in my record, this woman is not psychotic, she is not dangerous. And at that point, that should have been the first opportunity, but that wasn't made into an opportunity. And then there was, when I took a psychological test that showed that there was nothing psychologically wrong with me, that should have been an opportunity to leave, but that wasn't presented to me as an opportunity. The first opportunity that I had to leave was on the 22nd or the 21st day, when the court order came through and said I was transferred. And so to put in the affidavit that I was allowed to leave the hospital at the first opportunity, that's grossly misleading.
So that was
just one thing, and there were like a few things in there. So that by omission or by implication, the affidavit was false. Now, this is how I think that we got that affidavit. I think that he probably read it to me in his office, and so if he would say, did you leave at the first opportunity, and I'd say yes, that would go into the affidavit, right? And it would be in fact truth, but in reality, grossly misrepresenting the situation. So anyway, I was trying to fire him. The judge, all three of us went prancing up before the judge. The judge told him to withdraw from the case. He said, you do it right now. You go across the hall and do it before you leave this building. And so we all went out in the hall, and he said to me, I'm not doing it. I'm not withdrawing from the case today. I'll do it on the 15th when this case comes to summary judgment or whatever. And so I didn't know what to do. I mean, the judge couldn't influence him. The judge didn't make it an order. He just told him to do it. So I was bewildered. If that false affidavit became valid, I could lose everything. I would have lost everything. So then I had to go to another lawyer to ask him what to do, and he didn't know what to do. He never heard of such a thing. So I wound up going to the disciplinary committee of the Supreme Court and explaining in writing what happened and waiting for their reply, and they said that he didn't do anything wrong, believe it or not. So then I wrote another letter to the disciplinary committee thinking I must not have explained myself. I didn't make myself clear. And so the second time it came back that he didn't do anything wrong. And what happened with the judge was that after the judge had told him to withdraw and he didn't withdraw, I waited one day because I had to think about it. I didn't know what to do, and I couldn't figure out what to do. And that was on a Wednesday that happened. So on Thursday, I didn't do anything. But on Friday, when I went back down to the court, I know you're not supposed to see the judge unless the other side is there, but I had to ask him if there was anything else I could do. And when I went there, he wasn't there. He was in the hospital, believe it or not. What a day. So I couldn't ask him anything. And then I had to wait several weeks before he came back to the courtroom, or maybe even several months. And when he came back, he was totally different attitude toward me. He wasn't pleasant, and he told me that if he told the lawyer that he had to withdraw from the case, that it was just a suggestion, and that the lawyer didn't have to do it. So there I was. I mean, it's been a real, real battle, and I'm exhausted by it.
And how? What is the current status? What's your next move in legal sense?
We filed in the appellate. No, we filed in the Court of Appeals, and within the next 9 months, it'll come up again. I mean, the case will come to court, I guess. I have two good lawyers.
Good. I'd like to ask you, like, a question. When you felt like that you were being influenced to do something, what were you feeling at the time? How did it feel to be controlled?
It feels different ways. It depends on, you know, what the situation is like. Lately, sometimes across my mind will fall an idea that's like totally foreign to anything that I've ever thought or done or been or stood for in my life. Like, look at that person over there. He looks like a slob, or he looks like a stupid idiot. Well, see, now I never thought that way, and I never said things like that. And so when these thoughts come on my mind, I feel like they're just being projected there. They don't feel like they belong to me. They feel foreign. Another example of this is one night a long time ago when I was single, I had a date with a person, and during that time of 4 or 5 hours, I found swearing, cursing, using, you know, foul language, and I never have done that really in my whole life. I don't mean I've never said anything that never ever in my life sworn, but I never talk like that. It's not part of my parlance, and it was just, seemed to be part of me that evening, and it was surprising to me that I would say those things. So each time that you do something that's not part of you but is being projected onto you, you're likely to have a different experience of it. But usually, for me, no one is more surprised about what's happening than I am. And it's like you lose a sense of intimacy with yourself. You can't tell who you are, what you're likely to do when this is going on. Kay Basher's book talks about, she had this happen to her, and she was getting messages like, kill your children. And she's very smart and introspective, and she was able to figure out why this was happening. And her book will be very helpful to anyone who is wondering if they might be a victim, or anyone who knows someone who's a victim and wants to understand better what's going on.
Now, Blanche, you're the U.S. coordinator for the Advocacy Committee for Human Experimentation Survivors of Mind Control. What is the work that you do with AICS-MC, and what are your goals?
Well, we have recently, as you know, completed a video which is meant to inform people in the general public. Well, it was a message to the president for Memorial Day, asking him to please help us. We are trying to get this network torn down that has been doing this. We would like to see the whole network torn down. We would like to have a hearing. We would like you to know, Mr. President, what exactly people who are mind control survivors are saying. And we would like you to have an investigation of what they're saying. We want you to find out, you know, what exactly is going on and what can be done to stop it. Recently, the Senator John Glenn's bill was passed. So that is a bill banning experimentation on humans. We advocate for victims by helping them find resources for, like, maybe they want to go and have imaging done. Someone might call me and ask me if I know of a safe place where they can go to get CAT scans or X-rays or whatever they need to diagnose their situation. They might call me to be hooked into a network so that they can talk to other people who are survivors. we try to bring this to the attention of authorities who can help us take it down.
So approximately how many survivors have you been in touch with, and in what kind of geographical locations?
Well, I think there are a lot of survivors from around the Great Lakes. All of the Great Lakes seem to have a higher percentage than the other states. They are actually in every state in the United States and all over Canada, too. But there is a heavy concentration around the Great Lakes. And Lynn, who was on your program today, and I were both victims in the town of Oswego. And that was how we got to know each other, actually, is at a conference a couple years ago. You know, it's a horrible thing to be in the situation that she was in as a little girl, but it was so wonderful to me to meet her and to have my own experience validated, and I think it was for her, too, to meet somebody. It's like you were both in the same concentration camp. You didn't know each other when you were there, but you're able to validate the experience because you've been in the same rooms. You've been in maybe with some of the same people.
And you both have been in contact with a lot of the survivors or people that think they have been involved in the experimentation.
Been in contact with several hundred people who have participated in the data bank, and we have been in contact with thousands of people probably who have either sent us email or called us or in some way communicated that they think they're victims. Of course, you know, we don't think that every single person who talks to us necessarily is a victim, but we think that every person who thinks that they are a victim should have an opportunity to tell their story and let it be investigated.
Right. What's your sense of how many people and children were involved in these experiments? And this is going back now more than 50 years.
Yeah, right. You know, I can't say how many over the years. It is enormous, though. It is really enormous. I wouldn't want to speculate on a number.
What would you say are the main concerns of mind control survivors now?
Well, individuals who are mind control survivors usually are very pressed financially. Most of them are on disability, if indeed they get that. Some of them don't even have that. Most of them have serious health concerns. We need to have help that will allow people to get a true evaluation of their situation and then treatment for it, and that will include help with their relationships within their families. In general, the group of victims needs to be heard. The public needs to know that it's going on because they're all at risk. And the only way to prevent becoming a victim, if there is any way at all, is to be at least very aware of what's going on.
And what would you like to see as an outcome of presidential hearings or a Canadian Commission of Inquiry into the mind control experiments, particularly on children?
I would like to see the hearings. I would like the public to begin to become aware that this is going on and to realize that they may very well be victims. I would like compensation in some cases. People who've, you know, lost their lives or been devastated by this should be compensated. I would like to see it stopped.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much, Blanche, for joining us as part of this radio series, and wish you the best of luck in your legal case and just yourself personally.
Thank you very much, and thanks for inviting me today.
We've been listening to an interview with Blanche Shabusti, a survivor of U.S. government mind control. This has been show number 31 in the series on mind control. More information about AIKS-MC and their campaign and video is at their website, www.aikes-mc.org. Tapes and transcripts of this series are now available at the office of CKLN at the price of $8 per tape or $3 per transcript of each show.
You can call the station to get a catalog of the tapes, available at 595-1477 during office hours. I'd like to thank everybody that also pledged their generous support for this show and CKLN during our very successful funding drive 2 weeks ago. You're listening to CKLN 88.1. Stay tuned for A Keen West for America, coming up next.